Okay, good. So the first shiur of this summer is about Darshin and Talmud Ikra. You have the Makorot ready for the first set, which is really as far as I'm prepared. So we don't have any. We're not under any rush this summer, as opposed to some other summers. Because if it takes the whole summer to get through this Makorot set, that's okay. Or if it doesn't, then I have a lot more learning to do, which is good. Now the other interesting thing is that we're going to start with the Shin and Talmud Ikra, but I want to be upfront that after the first 25 minutes of the first shiur that's officially on the topic of Bishul Nachrei, we will probably never mention anything D'oraita again. So one of the interesting bridges that I'm going to have to make is to try and find some way to bridge you from an introductory shiur on the Shin and Talmud Ikra to a discussion of the Rabbanan. So you should all be thinking about that, because we're going to work on the general assumption that all the halachot of Bishul Nachrei are derabanan, although we will modify that to some degree in the opening 25 minutes of the first specifically topical shiur. Okay, the agenda for today is really just to get the sugya on the table and your own theories of both the sugya and the Rambam out there. Tomorrow we'll do the two explanations of Lechem Mishnah, the Minchas Chinuch, and Margolis Hayam, and various other attempts that have been done in the past to construct them. You may have anticipated all of them, and at the end we'll try and come up with a comprehensive theory of theories that explain it, which hopefully is helpful for us in general in understanding the nature of halakhic decision making, which is why this is the introduction. So okay, so let's start with a volunteer to read the Sugya in Sanhedrin. Have you volunteer? All your servers are on the computer. That's an issue. Do you share? What? You should need to share anyway. Maybe, you know, Ellie, you want to start reading?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, good. So Yehuda, what are the three questions you want to ask Ellie about that Mishnah?
First of all, why did Rabbi Yehuda understand the mitzvah as, I guess, it's part of that?
What does Rabbi Yehuda understand the mitzvah?
Not the mitzvah of Lo Yibel Anashim.
Yeah.
Lo Yasur Lipo. Second of all, why Shmona Asur? Where did that come from?
Okay, so let's start. So the first question was, how does Rabbi Yehuda understand which mitzvah?
Lo
Yirbeh L'Anashim. What does he understand as the prohibition, granted that he says Marbehu Lo? Okay, second question you have is, where did the number 18 come from, which are presumably related questions. Okay, what was the third question?
One third question is, how would he answer Rabbi Shimon's question? Why would he be allowed to marry two wives who would cause you to worship the Lord's God?
So how would he answer Rabbi Shimon's question as to why would you be, why, right, that was, why should, right, that's another version, it's not, they're all versions of the number 18. Right, over the number 18, like, why would we pick the number 18 as opposed to simply saying, don't marry wives who cause you to be Messiah, period. Right. Okay, good. So Ellie, how would you answer those questions?
All three of them.
Yeah, let's start with any one of them.
Okay. So first of all, so Rabbi Yehuda would understand, he would read the two pesukim of the two clauses of pasuk lo yirbeh l'anashim and lo yasur together. So lo yirbeh l'anashim is coming to teach that you shouldn't have more than 18 wives. And lo yasur is saying a specific type of wife, or pelegesh, I guess.
Okay, so Rabbi Yehuda says that the lo yasur levavo is modifies it. Lo yirbeh l'anashim unless.
Yeah.
They would be masirat. They would be masirat levavot.
And if they are not masirat levavot, so then you can have an infinite number.
Okay. All right. So that's how we write levavot hashem vilo yasir is levavot hashem sol. Right. If they will cause it. Yes.
According to that formulation, what's wrong with having less than 18 wives who are all trying to drive you off the path of goodness?
What's wrong with it?
Yeah.
Nothing's
wrong with it.
Yeah. At least nothing is.
The Easterners have 18 wives at the same time trying to drive you off the path of Torah and Mitzvah.
19.
19.
So 18. There's no doraita problem with that.
There's
no special kingly issue.
Yeah, we don't know that they're all 18. You know, it's an interesting question about whether he thinks that you can have 18 wives. You know, the liminal, the case between the two of you is what happens if I have 16 wives who wish to be Maestri Levavi and 95 wives who don't.
I think that's fine.
That's fine. It's only right. So you can have as many wives as you want. As right, it's just you can't have more than 18 wives who are trying to drive you off the derech.
Or once you have so many wives, you have one wife who's trying to drive you off.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, right? Whether the limit is 18, including any who try to drive you off, or the limit is 18 who are trying to drive you away. That's good. I never thought of that before. So,
so it seems to be really about the quality of the person, not necessarily the quantity.
The quality. Well, he does have a limit, yes, but even if...
So
if
in that sense, is that necessarily true to the text? Or, I'm saying if we're having your beds more than 18,
yeah.
Then is that really true to the text?
Is that true to the text? Well, we're having the reading of the text, right? Don't have more than 18 as long as they're not Maesir. As far as if they are Maesir, and if they're not Maesir, then why would we have any objection? The more wives, the better. I guess. right. But that is a okay, but that's a really interesting reading, right? Whether you can have 18 evil wives and simultaneously an infinite number of good wives.
I assume not.
You assume not.
I assume definitely you can have 18 wives who are mystical people and then an infinite number of good wives. There's no reason to choose.
Once you have lots of wives, the odds are one of them is going to be trying to be messier.
I don't know. Depends on your taste, I would think.
Transforms into...
Maybe. We can start getting ridiculous here and saying, yeah. You know, if you have 1,080 good wives, right, that are the bad wives about the Bashishan and all sorts. We could try. I suspect not. So
no, you're being beloved Zechus on Shlomo.
That's why Shlomo had 1,000. It was really 1,080. That was really 1,081 or something like that. There's potential there. I'm not sure which day of the year there's potential. But there's potential. Okay, so it's an interesting machloket up front. So your answer. So now we know how he reads the pasuk. Where does he get the number 18 from?
He doesn't say.
Okay, and what was the third question? Why should this be, right? Why should you be allowed to have 18 wives who are seeking to drive you from the true path? What is Rabbi Huda's motive? Well, you can frame that question, right? Now, that may be a bad question, right? Why would somebody choose to interpret the verse in such a way that it allows you to have 18 wives who are trying to drive you off? Lidera. Okay, yes.
Can I jump back half a topic? Because we sort of slid over the number 18.
Uh-huh.
And we were using pronouns to describe who's saying 18.
Okay.
It doesn't look clear to me that Rabbi Yehuda is saying 18 any more or less than Rabbi Shimon is.
Okay, good. So it's true that in the state, Rabbi Yehuda per se, there is no mention of 18. The question is whether Rabbi Yehuda is literarily dependent on the Tanakhama. Right? The Tanakhama says, L'Rabbi Anashim Elish Manas, right? So if Rabbi Yehuda is going directly on the verse, so then it's right, so then he says, the number Lo Yarbeh, whatever you take that number to be, right, doesn't apply to good wives. Right,
that would mean only one evil wife.
No, he says the prohibition, you know, I don't know, 18, it could be 16, it could be, I don't think he's not committed to 18. We don't know what your bed means.
If he doesn't have 18, then it's presumably 1.
It has to be 18.
No, it's not. Not 18, 1.
Whatever your bed means, everything's dependent on what the word your bed means.
Your bed could mean 2.
If there's no,
it has to be 1.
We start off with assumption there's a limit of 18 wives.
Yeah.
If we say that Rabbi Yehuda throws out the assumption there's a limit of 18 wives, says, have as many wives as you want, but don't have X number of wives that are causing you to turn from the true path.
Yeah.
So, isn't that blank space, I wouldn't logically put in the number 18 there. I would logically put in number 1.
Okay.
Then,
I wouldn't
put in the number that is like Rabbi Shimon.
Maybe, or yeah. Probably, maybe there's some other number. Really, let's bracket that question. There, 1 is certainly a logical number, right? Although 0 is also a logical number.
Well, maybe there wouldn't be a special kingly Esor.
Yeah, okay. I'm open, but it also might be that
because the king is the head of state, he's responsible.
Yeah, but if Stephen is correct, then we would just say, you know what, we don't know what his number 18 is. If he doesn't assume, we don't know what his number is. We don't know. We don't understand where 18 comes from yet, right? Maybe, however, the Tanakama gets 18, he has another source which gets us 6.
I've seen it darshaned out. So, like, I don't know, I'm working with a different...
Okay, right, I would tend to take the position that he is literally dependent, but let's, right, but we can, and it's 18 anyway, but we can leave that for now.
But it just sounded to me like we were attributing
that's
to,
right.
to Rabbi Yehuda.
And that's not fair. That's right. We don't know that for sure. We only know that if he is literally dependent on the Tanakama. Yes, Yehuda.
We're making an assumption that Rabbi Yehuda is talking about the evil wives and good wives.
Uh-huh.
I'm not so sure. It could be many wives could make and do wrong things. Would any of the wives individually be fine? It could be there's a certain threshold, you have so many wives that you end up doing.
Right, but he says Marbel lo uvilvaz. That means he has to believe that there is.
Shelo yihu misirat libo. It's not.
Shelo yihu uvilvaz shelo yihu.
Oh,
so that I'm saying that it could be multiple wives to be able to convince them to do wrong things.
Oh,
it depends on the case.
Oh, let's try to understand. According, you heard it. So when is he Marbel? Up to 18? Is that what you're saying?
No, up to the point where they would start causing to do wrong things.
And it's subjective.
It is subjective. Well, no. Once he does the wrong thing, then he's chayav on the mitzvah of the...
So everybody, right, so you just... So the goal is the king can keep marrying wives, all right? And he can marry an infinite number of wives until he goes bad. And
no,
he will never know in advance.
They would make him go bad. Until he has to figure that out.
Okay. So it's just the mitzvah. The king is warned in advance that multiple wives... Right, multiple wives carry the risk of causing you to stray, and he has to make his own decision as to when that point comes, and whether we hold him liable or not depends on whether he made a reasonable decision.
And that could be where 18 comes from. The number of wives they estimate is too many, and you can't.
So in that case, you know, Rabbi Yehuda doesn't. There's no circumstance in which Rabbi Yehuda tells you in advance you can have an infinite number of wives, and it's not different kinds of wives. It's just a judgment as to how many wives you can have.
Yeah.
Everyone has to make their own judgment.
Right.
Okay.
I think I can support Yehuda's read of what it means.
Yeah.
By change what it means to take his heart.
Yeah.
So we thought to take his heart would like to make him sin, but it could be like based on the way the Rambam interprets that, is it the Rambam thinks as a head of state he has to be open to be involved in head of state, and if he's just attending to all of his wives,
uh-huh.
the number of wives could just reach a point in time without any particular wrongdoing. He's just so involved in dealing with all of his wives, those are the bloom tree, the court struggles, whatever, that he's not a responsible monarch.
It's a function of time management.
Yes.
Okay. And
so
then
Yehuda says an efficient person with excellent time management could have more wives.
So in this reading, the machlok is in this reading, the Tanakhama sets out an absolute number of 18. Rabbi Yehuda just objects to the notion that we should set out a rule that is objective as opposed to a subjective criterion. Right, that's the way you want to read it down.
Yes.
Okay. So let's leave that as a possibility also. Okay. Anybody have another question they want to ask about the Mishnah? Sorry, have a question?
Well, I was just curious about Daphne and Abigail, what that was really implying. That was something we discussed in our
Abigail, okay. So we have to figure out why, you know, what is
not just
it?
Specifically, like, why choose her as opposed to another woman, but just, like, what was it kind of modifying? What was the implication of the, like, we...
Okay, good, right. So an interesting question about who Abigail is. And obviously, underlying it is that 18 comes from somewhere, right? 18 is some notion, right? 18, we take David HaMelech... Right, we seem to take David HaMelech as a good marrier.
Right.
Not only a good marrier,
yeah. What do you want to say? I'm going to marry her, but...
Don't worry about it.
Okay, Josh, what do you want to say?
Oh, I just mean, because... I mean, one of the drashas of how we get 18 is that David Melech married 6 wives, and then you play around with the psukim and say, oh, he could have married 3 times that.
Yes.
So 3 times 18, 3 times 6 mm-hmm. is 18. And then Abigail is one of... And then Abigail fits into this whole how many wives can a king marry paradigm, because we base it off David, and David married Abigail, and she's an example.
Right, but why Abigail not Bathsheba? That's right, that's right.
Well, she's not a Navi. Navia. Bathsheba's not a Navia. Abigail is a Navia. She's different.
Is Abigail a Navia?
Yeah, she's
one of the listening. Interesting. That's what I think, it's because she's a
Navia. She's a supremely righteous woman.
She's righteous.
She's also the third one.
She's righteous.
Yeah, but who wants to be married?
She's the third one we don't like to call. She's the first one. She's the first one David marries that we actually really like.
Aha. Uh-huh.
She's the third one, and we don't really particularly like Michal.
But wait a minute. I mean,
but what, that's really nice. But how does this really, like, how does this fall into the machloket?
Because she.
Yes.
If it's about Misirat Libo, she does the opposite. When he wants to kill Naval, and she says, no, you can't do that. She's doing the opposite of taking him away. She's bringing him back to where he ranks
today. I think that's right. I think I'm going to lose
the...
Yeah.
Filu, meaning like, even if you are so certain that all of these wives are the opposite of Misirat Libo, that they're like Avigail, even then the numeric limit still applies.
19 wives dragging you
they're
back to the
neutral.
Straight and narrow.
They're actually...
Wait, how do you get that? Because I would think that if you were going to make the comparison to Abigail, right, then that means any one particular woman who had a certain characteristic could, you know, turn your heart. And it wouldn't be a function of how many. It would just be a function of...
Yeah, so Abigail is the good wives, right? So even if you have 18 wives, all of whom are trying to drag you to the good or to the good path, you still can't do it.
Okay.
Okay, so now the question we would then ask is, according to Rabbi Shimon, what is the connection between Lo Yarbel Nashim and Lo Yasir Levavo? Right, since he says explicitly the prohibition applies even if they're like Abigail. Now you could say that Rabbi Shimon holds that because of the time management issues, right, even 19 wives who are like Abigail, even if each of those wives individually seeks to pull you back to the straight and narrow, the collective impact of 19 marriages, right, will distract or cause the king distress. Right, you could take that position. Yes.
Could you argue that Rabbi Shimon was taking a more like low-poop type argument of like even if they're all good and even if having a lot of wives would like objectively be a problem in certain cases, then we just don't make exceptions.
Yes. Right. So the other possibility is that he's taking again the objective position. We don't right first of all, and this is an important thing. You can always take an objective rule position on the grounds that the attempt to make, we need to have a rule, right? We could do it case by case, but we're afraid that other people will get it wrong. Or you can do it because we don't believe that that we'll get it right. And we just, right, you know, that we just don't, right? It's not just we need a rule, it's that we don't think it'll work. Of course you could have an infinite number of good wives, but we just don't think you'll be able to pick. All right, yes.
Is the other argument that he's just seeing the two is not necessarily connected?
And he could be just saying, so it could be that Rabbi Shimon is just reading it, saying that he's just happened to be, right, so how would you read Lo Yasir Levavo then, not as a reason, but as a?
As another isur.
As another isur. King should not stray. Right?
It's still referring to the wives, so it has to be somewhat connected, but.
Why? Why does that refer to the wives?
Because he's saying that afilu achatu misirat libo. He's not saying he shouldn't stray in general. He's talking about the wives.
The Rabbi Shimon says, so Yasir Levavo is a prohibition against marrying wives who will cause you to stray. And then Lo Yarbel Nashim is an objective prohibition against marrying too many wives. Okay, good. So now.
Well, I would think that the two chassids really are just meant to be juxtaposed because they're in the same pasuk.
Well, that's how we know it's about wives.
Yes.
Right, even though, right, it's two commandments about wives, Lo Yarbelo and Lo Yasir Levavo. Okay, yes, Ramah.
Why doesn't it give us an example of a bad wife? It tells us what a really good wife is. It doesn't tell us what a really bad wife is.
Interesting question, right? Why don't we have Izebel, right, in the... Pardon?
We do
have Izebel, yes. Hey, good, okay, very good. Yes, Jeff.
I was going to suggest that every, you know, we're talking about, like, about these, like, good people as if these purely good people exist, but really everyone's, like, a mixture of...
Uh-huh. But Abigail is apparently purely good.
No, she's... She's a high percentage of
good. Uh-huh. Okay, we have an example of someone's high percentage of bad, right? It's just there's a lack of symmetry in that, right? In that, right? You know, he doesn't say, right, afilu achat kemo so-and-so mesirat liva, at least in our version. Yes, Rita?
The one problem, if you say mesirat liva is like time management, is it just like the bad life? So you don't have time for it?
Uh-huh.
Then how can we say the king can't have children if he doesn't have time? If the king doesn't have children, you run into all sorts of big problems. Say afilu achat.
Aha, because you think children are more distracting than
No.
He's saying
not having an heir
will cause...
The king has children, become, that's a big problem.
Well, then he should divorce some wives, and they remarry new
ones. What are you trying to
say? If it's not a
obviously we can say a king shouldn't marry a bad wife. It's not a problem.
Yeah.
But if we say Monsieur Libo is like a time management thing,
yeah,
then if he can't find the time to marry one wife, it's a big problem. Because he can't have children.
Well, we shouldn't have a king who can't time manage well enough to carry out one relationship. Probably
but
is not the.
Peter thinks he can have 18.
Probably
problems.
Is not the right king. The truth is that the wife we should be mentioning is not Abigail, but whom? Which wife should we mention? Sorry, it's not Izebel. Which wife should we mention? Bat-Paro is exactly right. Mm. Right, that's really interesting thing is right because our paradigm of the good marrier, of the good marrier is David, but our paradigm of the bad marrier is Shlomo. And right, and in Chazal's vision, right, Bat-Paro, you know, seduces Shlomo into Avodah Zarah on the night the Beit HaMikdash is open. Right, where she tricks him into staying in bed too late and not getting there in time to open the doors of the Beit HaMikdash. So it's interesting that we don't pick Shlomo as the model. Okay, good, but none of you asked what I think is the first level shot question, I guess, in the Mishnah, which is, how many positions are there in the Mishnah?
Three.
Obvious that there are three?
Could be two.
Yeah.
Could be two. Okay, Sparamachal, if it's two, if it's two, right, so who are the two positions?
Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon.
Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, and then what about the opening line? Who's that?
That's the Stam. They both agree. They're commenting on it.
They're both commenting on it, okay, right? So Sparamachal takes what is the standard academic position.
Yes.
Right, the standard academic position is that you have the Mishnah Rishona, which said Le'er Bel and Hashem El Hashem El Asrei, and the Machlok and Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon is about how to understand that precedent. Okay, right, and both of those are reasonable readings of the Mishnah. You can connect it if you want, right? You could read Epstein and Albeck and all those people and try and see right all the places in Mishnah where you seem to have a structure like this. The Stam in the Gemara will often ask the question, Mai Beinayu, when you have situations like this, and it will construct a nafkamina between the anonymous Tanakama and the name position that seems to say the same thing. The problem is that often you can't tell at the end of it which side holds which way of the nafkamina, right, which makes it hard to be fully convinced that was the intended meaning of the Mishnah, right? If there's the only nafkamina you can come up with is one which you can go either way on each position. The example that I always keep in mind is the first Mishnah in the fourth parak of Rosh Hashanah. So you can look it up where the Gemara is talking about the different which kind of bezdin between the Tanakama. Which the Tanakhamas and Rabbi Yezra's position, I think, and it ends up that it's a particular kind of bezin, but there's machlokas rishonim about which one holds which. So you can take your position, I think that you have to raise the issue of whether there are two or three positions in the Mishnah, and we'll have to play that through. Okay, good. So let's take a look at the Gemara. Okay, we have a volunteer who hasn't spoken yet in Shir to read. There, Gabrielle, you're elected. You still have a Sanhedrin? Okay, fine. Okay.
The name is Rabbi Yehuda Darish Tamar Nikra. Rabbi Shimon Lo Darish Tamar Nikra.
So what does that mean?
So this to imply that Rabbi Yehuda is Darish Tamar Nikra and Rabbi Shimon is not.
Okay, so that means that we're assuming that the simplest reading of the Mishnah would tell you that Rabbi Yehuda is Darish Tamar Nikra and Rabbi Shimon is not. Okay, why is that?
Because Rabbi Yehuda is being dependent on. He is saying like he can have as many as long. He's like being very dependent on the reason, but the reason is as long as they don't stray you, so you can have as many as you want as long as you don't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Rishon says, so prima facie, Rabbi Yehuda sets a limit which is dependent on the rationale, right? Yarbeh means don't have the bad kinds of wives, right? The wives who are mesir. And Rabbi Shimon says explicitly that you cannot have even the best kinds of wives. And we are discounting, at least at the outset, the notion that Rabbi Shimon's position is that this number of wives causes you to stray. Right? Because if Rabbi Shimon held this number of wives causes you to stray, right, then he would be Darish Tamar Nikra also. Right? So we have to be claiming that Rabbi Shimon is disconnecting the Isur from the right from the rationale. Yeah.
But Rabbi Shimon still says that even if there's one who can have that effect on you, then marrying her is asur.
Good. So now the question is that Isur lo yirbelu nashim? Or is it a different Isur?
Right, it seems to be a different
Seems to be a different Isur. Right. But in terms of the Isur lo yirbelu nashim, right, the prima facie position of the Gemara is that Rabbi Shimon disconnects it and says there is a prohibition against being marbeh, which he defines as more than 18, regardless of whether they will cause you to stray. Right? And not right, he's not taking a statistical thing or he's just saying because if he says you have to make a rule, then again he could be Darish Tamid Ikra. He just says in general having 18 wives will cause you to stray, so you can't have 18 wives either. He doesn't say that, right? The Gemara says prima facie Rabbi Shimon learns this in a way which simply makes it a rule that is disconnected from rationales, whereas Rabbi Huda learns it as a rule which is wholly dependent on rationale. All right, he said, right, the whole prohibition is against having the number of wives that causes you to stray, leaving open the question, okay, but according to Rabbi Huda, why is it that you get up to 18?
Oh, right. Yeah. Not necessarily just that one is dependent on rationale and one isn't. It's one is dependent on that particular rationale. I mean, it could be that he has two Isur and they're both dependent on rationale, so it's just not this one. It's not.
Well, so that's what do we read as Rabbi Shimon is not the Havamina. I mean, it seems to be that the machloket is a broad machlokas in jurisprudential practice. Right, it doesn't say the name of Rabbi Shimon thinks that this is the Rabbi Yehuda thinks this is the reason Rabbi Shimon thinks it's not. Right, it sets it up explicitly as an abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
Right, do you mean to tell us that Rabbi Yehuda takes the principal position Dorish Tamid Ikra, and Rabbi Shimon takes the principal position Lo Dorish and Tamid Ikra? Right, we could have said it's about right.
Okay,
now you could tell me no, I'm overreading it. How do I know in the language of this Gemara that it's generic? Right, maybe it's saying. Right, maybe we could read this Gemara as saying, "Do you mean to say that Rabbi Yehuda is dorish the this ta'am of this kra, and Rabbi Shimon is not?" Right. So my presumption for not saying that is that the same language is used all throughout the Talmud whenever this machloket comes up.
Yeah.
Right. So my presumption is that it means the same thing in each case, and it's an abstraction.
But why would you bring up an abstraction multiple times? Like, why would you have to prove an abstraction more than once?
Well, we'll see whether they ever succeed in proving it. It's a good question. Okay, we'll go through that. All right, so let's hold that also, right? That I can't prove linguistically, right? Just on the local evidence, I can't prove it linguistically. So we'll have to see as we go through all the cases whether I can prove it comprehensively. Yes, Yudin.
One last thing.
Yeah.
The language of the pasuk is not language of reason. It's not like let's say ki or the ma'an or something. It says velo yabel ashiv, velo yaso libo, velo v'ketas v'hav lo yabel omel. It's not a usual case of where the Torah does. Only from what the words are can we guess that this is probably a reason for the previous thing. But from the grammatical structure, there's no reason to assume this is a reason.
Okay, so
I'm just trying to point out that the way we understood the Bishamon is not stretching the text of the Torah.
No, it's not at all. So what I'm agreeing with you here is that it's not obvious. It's not obvious, I think, to anyone reading this text that the machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon is a generic machloket about Darshin and Talmud Ikra. Right? That's a big leap. Yeah, the Gemara begins by saying, do you mean to imply that? But really, we could just say, no, we didn't mean to imply that at all. Right? They're having an argument about this pasuk. Right? We have to ask the question, why does the Gemara jump to this assumption that is the basis of the machloket when it's not obvious, and as we go through the sugya, there is no mention of a possibility that it is a local machloket. Right? The entire sugya proceeds on the premise that Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon are arguing about something which is not specifically related to this pasuk. Right? But that's not in any way obvious in the sugya, right? Obvious in the text, right? Not it doesn't follow from the machloket, right? It could just be that they're having an argument about how to read this pasuk, right? You would have pointed out very correctly that lo yarbeh v'lo yasir, right? But now we could have a whole Tanakh discussion about whether consecutive, right, whether consecutive negatives, right, imply subordination or not. Right, we don't say it about lo tirtzach, lo tignov, lo tefnod, right? All right, don't kill because you'll end up stealing from people. All right? Yeah. Don't sleep with other people's wives because you'll end up desiring them. the mixed dancing joke is out there.
Masaris the Quran.
Yeah.
I'll find it. I did see a parish that connected one to the next. Don't do this because
it'll lead to that, to that, to that.
Right.
Not the other way around. Doesn't
it
go backwards.
Was,
the chain doesn't go backwards.
It started with.
It's like how they're all like one big mitzvah, because like they're all connected.
I'll find it.
It would be fun to do a Maimonidean virtue ethic thing. That's saying it's all that really matters is habits of mind. So the ultimate sin is desire. Right, and the problem with doing other things is simply because it eventually leads you to have inappropriate desires, which is a reflection of poor character, as opposed to actions. Right, which is, you know, it's the inverse of the claim that mitzvot are supposed to bring you to habits of mind, right? So mitzvot are supposed to bring you to habits of mind, and that's, right? So then averot are supposed to, right, are wrong because they bring you to bad habits of mind, but they're not intrinsically problematic at all. Interesting position. Then we get to, you know, the classic position of Shlomo, right? I'll marry them all and it won't be my sirut levavi, right? Because he thinks that all that matters is character. I don't think that works historically terribly well, but I'm thinking of specifically is Rav Tzedekah Cohen of Lublin, who thinks that real avodas Hashem takes place while you're asleep, because the only real avodas Hashem that happens is when your mind is free, right? That's when you know who you really are, right? As whenever you're in conscious control. Right, who could be distorting your personality? It doesn't tell you who you really are, right? So the real test, the real test is what you dream about. So we could. Yes.
It wasn't exactly how I remembered, but it's Midrash. It's called Midrash Aseret HaDibrot, the Rav Moshe Darshan, and it all comes from Kavet Avicha Vetimecha. It says Shehis Huzhar Bichvod Av Va'em Al Tomar Ehroget Ze Shebeyeshet Avid. And then it goes on, so you think, I can't kill them, but they all do ni'uf and like mess up their family life. But no, you can't do that either. And I think, I'll steal their stuff. No, you can't do that either.
Right, but it is backwards, right? Don't do these things. It's not a priority thing. It's not a priority chain. Okay, good. I'm trying to think also, always remind the position that the reason that Ben Sarah Mora gets skila. As opposed to Herod is because he'll end up killing somebody on Shabbos. Let me say, right? He'll end up stealing from people, and he'll end up killing somebody on Shabbos, and that's why he gets skila.
He's a very smart Ben Sarah Mora.
Yeah, so
he's very clever and creative at the way he kills people.
Kill people on Shabbos?
He wants to be as respectful as possible, of course.
And he wants to find a way to kill people, which that's the only violation of Shabbos.
I would have assumed that, that skila has an aspect of communal censure.
Uh-huh.
It says the whole community's participate. So you would think that there's some things the whole community has to participate in, you know, getting rid of.
That's because it's Shabbos.
Not Shabbos. No, just without what you just said.
You could do that. Yes, I know. It would be very easy to do it, but I think it's the Rush who says, right, that the lastem et habriot v'yavol l'harog b'shabbat or something like that. Okay. So we have a presumption. Lememra, right? Lememra, de Rabbi Huda darish tam dikra, de Rabbi Shimon lo darish tam dikra. And we say no, but v'hayivcha shamin ilhu, because we heard it backwards, because we heard the exact opposite, because here we bring in a breita, which we claim implies the reverse. In which Rabbi Huda says, Almana ben shi'aniya ben shi'ashira ein mashkinota, and Rabbi Shimon comes along, Ashira mashkinota, aniya ein mashkinota, right, and furthermore, v'ata chayav l'hachzirla, v'ata masi'ena shemra v'chaverta. So the last line, Rabbi Shimon's line, is kind of hard to understand at all. as to what it means. So Elliot, what do you think Rabbi Shimon's line means at all there?
The the possibly that he's Rabbi Shimon is implying a reason for the he's asserting the Tom in that in that line that because you cannot take her beged as a mashkon because in which case you'd be required to return it to her, and by and somehow in doing that then you'd be giving her a bad name, and giving her a bad name in the community is the reason, avoiding that is the reason for the issur.
Okay, so the reason, the regime is right, so if you take a mashkon from a poor person, so you end up having, right, so poor people can't actually afford to, right, can actually afford to not surrender, right, to not get their mashkon back. It's an interesting kind of mashkon. So what do you think is the, where do we get this idea that you have to return a mashkon? The whole point of a mashkon is that you're keeping it collateral.
Previous
psukim.
Say every night
you have to return.
Yeah, okay, right, so we're dealing with really poor people, right, and they're trained, right, and we're not just talking about returning your mashkon to her, we're talking about a woman showing up at your door every night to get her pajamas.
No, you return it to her. You go to her house.
That's what it seems to plan.
Or you go to her, even go to her house. Every evening, the rich guy is going to show up at her door holding her pajamas. And then in the morning, he's going to show up holding her day clothing. And we could see how that might conceivably create a sense of ill repute. Although many of these things are circular. Right? As long as everybody knows that she's poor and she took money, right? So then you have an amatla, right? He's only here because the because of that. Okay, yes, you have.
The thing about just in this case, the Rishon would seem to be more machmir in the case of a woman who was never married.
It should be aha. Why are we particularly concerned about the feelings about the reputation of a widow?
According to Yehuda, it's simple. It's that that's what it says in the Torah. It seems to be that it shouldn't just be a widow, it should be anyone.
And if I were to ask you up front, why does the Torah tell you not to take collateral from a widow? The pasuk says take the garment of a widow as collateral. Right? So what would we ordinarily think? It's because what?
She's poor and without a social network to support.
Because taking people's clothing as collateral is being excessively concerned about getting your money back. Right? People who have to give you their clothing as collateral, right, are in desperate positions already, and you shouldn't do that.
But don't we already address that?
How?
General rules of the mashkon?
So now the interesting question, right? So the question is, why doesn't a... We have it, right, so it's probably differently. We already have a requirement about returning the mashkon. So this is a reasonable reconstruction of Vishima's thought process. You're not allowed to keep somebody's essential clothing anyway. You have to return it. Even if that means that you end up having to return pajamas during the day and wear clothing at night. Right? Even if it means that, you still have to do it. Now we have a claim that you're not allowed to take the garment of a widow as collateral at all. Why?
Possibly it's not the taking of the... Well, you don't have to take collateral, right?
Right.
You could just lend you the money and not take collateral. So there could be an assumption that anybody that you take collateral from is not good for it.
Uh-huh, so?
So then by asking her to... By taking collateral from her, then you would sort of be implying that she was not good on her word.
I don't know. I think they take collateral from everybody, right? Otherwise, we take that.
You
don't have to. So we don't want to damage her credit rating by suggesting you have to take collateral from her.
Huh.
That's interesting. I'm not convinced. That's interesting. Yes, Yehuda.
Also, could we even say Almanah if she owns these things, right?
Uh-huh.
It's simply that the woman, at least in that time, they live in their father's house, or they were widow. There was no such thing as a single woman who lived by herself.
Uh-huh. Women, right? Single women wouldn't be in the condition, right? Socially, single women wouldn't be in condition to take out loans.
Not take out loans. I'm saying the problem is visiting someone's house.
Visiting someone's house who has their own household.
So
because if their father's there, they'll beat you up. And broke your back. That's it. I mean,
interesting.
Husband, same issue.
Okay. Have you heard it yet?
No, that's exactly what I was thinking. So the point is that it's not that you're taking that you have the problem of returning the coat is an issue of sort of returning something to the coat.
Okay, right, so we're claiming it's not, right, so Rabbi Shimon is doing a very good job. He's saying we have to understand why there is an additional prohibition against taking the garment of a widow when we already have an understanding of what it takes to protect the poor against having their clothing taken as collateral, which is we impose the obligation of returning it, which is probably, in the vast majority of cases, simply makes it not worth taking it in the first place.
So you have to have an added reason for why.
Right, so you need an additional reason. It's not to protect... Yeah.
That's because it's a damage to her, to what people would think about it, not...
Yeah, right. So it's a very reasonable reading of the pasuk in the end. All right, and then Rabbi Shimon says, okay, but rich widows, this is not an issue. Okay, yes, sir.
Well, I think it's because like most of the work was like, you know, the bigger and stronger you were, the better, and that's the work that men were doing.
Yeah.
It's like, let's say a poor laborer who had had good health.
Yeah.
He had earning potential every day, and he could get by. In a way, but a widow is in an even worse situation.
I was going to go back to the other position and say that widows, really, whenever you lend money to a widow, it's just a fig leaf.
It's just a stopper.
And so taking collateral is undermining the whole point, because the whole point is for her to be in a better position than she was anyway. She's not going to make any money anyway. All right. So okay, that's an interesting counter reading to Rabbi Shimon.
But why are we saying that this wouldn't apply also to the rich widow? Because it would, if it's not a material damage that you might be causing.
But rich widows can pay back loans too.
Mm. You're just not going to end up coming there every night. There's no issue with that.
Oh, okay.
Right. Either way, those are rationales as to why poor, right? So now we have two rationales. One, all right, one, which is Rabbi Shimon seems to give in the Mishnah, that it's because of Masiyah Shem Rab B'Chaverta. Another possibility is, look, recognize when you lend money to a widow, you're not supposed to want it back. To poor widows. You're not supposed to want it back because how are they going to pay back? I guess the answer is they could remarry. Right? Or they could have really good business sense. Yeah. Yes?
And another thing, point that we show, you have all sorts of other things. Like, for example, you would not be over on this Easter if you never gave it back in night. Just be over on the other.
Be over a different Easter.
Not this one. You couldn't be over both at once, according to the show.
You couldn't be over... Well, I don't know. It might be that you are... over it by putting yourself in a position where, in order to not violate the other mitzvah, you have to do this. I'm not sure that that follows logically. Right? It says lo sachvol. It doesn't say right lo tasiya shem rab bechaverta. Right? Same way it doesn't. It says lo yirbel anashim. Not lo yasir.
Right. The isur of taking the mashkon has a reason behind it, but it still
creates. Right. The interesting question is whether you could contract around it. Right. What happens if you have a poor widow? But she's not so poor. She has two changes of clothing, right? And she agrees, right? She agrees to let you keep this one article of clothing. Can you contract around it?
But isn't that just not under the definition of poor?
So that's an interesting question, right? Now we have a threshold category. We have category just like an issue of what Mesirut Libo meant, right? What defines a wife as someone who is Mesirut Libo, and how do you know that in advance, right? So with the same token, now we have a right now we have a question of what constitutes poor and rich, right? Do we really set the boundary as poor? Poor are people who have nothing, but, right, who if they give their clothing as collateral, have no other.